Do it another way. I'm going to be showing you a number of other paper cuts by Hans Christian Andersen, but we see here the angel with wings, and do look, because you're going to be spotting them over and over again, and the dancer, the ballet dancer, up on the butterfly, on either side of the butterfly, and the little figure wearing a sort of hood at the bottom is the Sandman, the bringer of dreams. Can you still hear me? Now, I think one thing most of us know about Hans Christian Andersen, because he kept telling everybody, was that he'd had a very hard youth, which he was lucky to survive. Well, now, the same is true of his stories. In spite of their early success, it is amazing that they have survived, let alone become world famous, because they were written not only in a minority language, Danish, but in a dialogue of that language, a dialect of that language, the dialect of Andersen's native island of Funen. And there it is. You can see Funen, which lies between the great peninsula of Jutland to the west and the big island of Zealand to the east, with Copenhagen on the northeast. I'm afraid my pointer doesn't work, so you're going to have to be awfully clever, but I'm sure you can manage. Anyway, Odense, second city of Denmark, is a three-day journey from Copenhagen by boat and coach, and fairly backward in many ways, with a lot of traditions still preserved. Andersen's dialect, in which he wrote his stories, the dialect of his native island, is called by the islanders themselves the tongue the angels speak on Sundays. So that's not in a bad start in theory, but it gets a lot worse. From this dialect, they were then translated. Aha, good. Aha. Oh, thank heaven. Thank
you. I wish to change the slides.
Lights down. Lights down, but okay. Thank you. All right. Thank you, Tim. Thank you. Check the errors work. Check they work. Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you. Look, from this dialect of Danish, they were translated not into ordinary Danish of Copenhagen, but straight into a completely different language, with long sentences, longer words, and a Latinate construction, the language, of course, of Denmark's great neighbour to the south, Germany. Whoops, pressed the wrong thing. No. Oh. There we are. Okay, Germany. Ooh. Anyway, you can see West Germany perfectly well without me trying to show you. Now, look. From German, they were then translated into English by English people who didn't speak Danish. Some of them hardly spoke any German, but they nonetheless translated Andersen's stories, and it was from English that the stories are then translated into over 100 more languages, with loss, obviously, of both accuracy and style. And Andersen, in his own dialect, was a great polisher. He would read his stories over and over again, aloud, to get them right for the ear as well as the eye. So they changed, and yet over the years, these altered and mutilated stories, in many instances, have been read by people all over the world. Now, part of the reason may be, I think, and you've just seen her now, their strong visual appeal. We all know who this is, by a contemporary French artist, but we can see not only the mermaid, very easily in our mind's eye can we not, but the duckling Thumbelina, the Snow Queen, and many others. Now, von Gogh loved Andersen's stories, and he writes in a letter to his brother Theo that Andersen has the soul of a visual artist. I'm sure that he also draws illustrations, says von Gogh, which Andersen didn't. Instead, he inspired other artists. But in youth, artists are Andersen's friends far more than are writers. And in youth too, as we'll see later, he produces many sketches of his travels mainly, and he produces his paper cuts throughout his life. A very elaborate one produced in his 50s. If I can press this pointer, yes. There's the dancer again. We're going to keep seeing her. There's the sun, that's another favorite motif. Somewhere we have the stork, that's another one. And we have a sort of Pierrot, a dancing Pierrot, which is Andersen himself. We'll see them over and over again. And we'll also see his sketches, his collages, illustrations to the stories by artists from all over the world. And we will look too at something else. A few of the contemporary Danish artists of his day, which is a period which has gone down to history as being the golden age of Danish painting. To begin with, something which becomes very celebrated in Denmark. Painted in the turbulent last decade of the 18th century by this artist, Jens Juel, who had studied in Hamburg, and he was very famous in Denmark. Now, and we go into history here, shortly before Andersen's birth, which was on the 2nd of April, 1805, Denmark, extremely small trading nation on the Baltic, in competition with others, was believed by England to be on the verge of a pact with France. During the Napoleonic Wars, she therefore suffers a preemptive strike at the hands of Nelson, which ruins her fleet. 6 years later, the fleet is then carted off to England. This is followed by national bankruptcy, a terrible fire in Copenhagen, and worst of all, in 1814, the loss of Norway, which had been part of Denmark for 400 years. The country is reduced to 1/7 of her former size, and it is assumed by many that she will, at some stage or other, who doesn't know when, be swallowed up by her great neighbour to the south. This painting by Jens Juel embodies her response, and it was snapped up immediately on its being produced as a metaphor for national recovery. As the farmer here in his wagon is hurrying back to the white farmhouse and the figure of his wife standing very upright here to avoid the gathering storm, so Denmark turns in upon herself, looks at her small self anew, makes a number of reforms already prior to the Napoleonic Wars. Far-reaching agricultural and social reforms have been underway, and now, under hideous pressure, the arts begin to flourish as they never have before, enabling Denmark to hold up her head abroad. And in return, her young artists, musicians, writers, sculptors receive generous state support. Most of them come from the middle classes, but there are a few exceptions, just about three. They get lots of grants and pensions in spite of the country's poverty, and it was not a bad time to be an artist, in fact, in Denmark, and few were more grateful for this than was one of the few members of the working classes to make it to the top, and here he is, portrayed in his late 20s. Doing rather nicely by the artist Christian Jensen, one of the Golden Age artists and Andersen's contemporaries. Now, over and over again, Anderson will express in public his gratitude for these grants and pensions that he gets, to his country, gratitude to God, to in whom he is a great, though unorthodox, believer. Elsewhere, though, in his journal, he writes privately, "In truth, I feel neither grateful, peaceful, nor happy. Not Denmark's fault. All his life he suffers extreme swings of mood due to a heritage on his father's side of mental instability. His father's father, a talented woodcarver, had lived to be an old man. He had gone pretty well mad and ended in the local asylum, teased and chased by local boys. Anderson's father, too, a cobbler, a very bright man, had gone the same way, but he died young." A great photograph taken of the great writer in Munich in 1862 when he's visiting Maximilian, the King of Bavaria. We see here the successful darling of the courts of Europe and the lion of the stately homes of Denmark, and a man of many friends, men and women. At around this time, on one of his many trips from Copenhagen to Europe, he stops off in his birthplace city, Odense. From the window of his grand hotel, he can see a young boy, clearly not quite right in the head, being teased and chased by older youths. The boy's face is sensitive, his eyes shine. "I thought of myself," says the writer, "and my grandfather, and wondered what would have become of me if I had remained at home." He probably would have become a tailor to please his mother. Now, this is a woodcut from a story that Anderson would write about his mother's later life, when she had to wash clothes in the river to keep going. Anderson's mother, Anne Marie, an ex-serving maid, knows the seamy side of life. One of her sisters kept a house of ill fame in Copenhagen, but the two women didn't speak. Before her marriage to Anderson's father, Anne Marie had borne a daughter out of wedlock, little Karen Marie, who lives with Anne Marie's mother in a village nearby. Hans Christian seldom meets her. He lives in dread of meeting this child of shame, in fact. But Anne Marie then marries a cobbler, Hans Andersen, a free thinker, an unbeliever, definitely an atheist, was Andersen's father, and a self-taught reader. And he teaches their only child to read the Bible, the Arabian Nights, and the writings of Voltaire, much to the horror of Anne Marie. At the local charity school, their boy daydreams, doesn't bother to write or spell, but he's very happy, in fact, years later, on a trip to Milan Cathedral. All of a sudden, the light pouring in through a stained glass window reminds him of the happiness of his early childhood, adored by his parents in one little room of the little house here, depicted by an artist called J.T. Hank, whom Anderson knew. And here it is, only one window for the Anderson family. Just one window, that's their window. Each of these windows is one narrow little room. And here is the house again. This is a fresco by a Dane called Niels Larsen Stevens of the one room in which the family live. There's the cobbler's bench, shoemaker's bench. There it is. And as Anderson writes, he says there are books on the shelves and there were pictures on the walls. Nonetheless, they keep a clean house. And here is something of enormous importance in the life, all the future life of Hans Christian Andersen. It is, we can't see it at all, but never mind, it is a puppet theatre. And father has made this puppet theatre. There's a puppet somewhere lying on the floor. He and the little boy do, in fact, play with it for hours. And this will play a vital role in his education. They make up plays, they read Shakespeare together, which has been recently translated, and they make and dress puppets. This will inspire him, his lifelong love of the theatre. And on the roof of the little house, there is another source of inspiration. A small garden where Anne-Marie grows vegetables and flowers, just a bit of flat bit of roof, really. And her son can go and be alone there. Years later, he puts the roof garden into his most famous story, one of them anyway, depicted here by Arthur Rackham. No, that keeps happening. There. There we have the little boy, Kai, hero of the story, on the left, and his friend Gerda, who is like a sister to him. Now, artists from all over the world have illustrated the story in many, many different ways. This is, as you see, Lars Bo, a Danish artist, mid-20th century. In the story, the Snow Queen, the garden, little garden, is really only a gutter between two houses. Here, the artist turns it into a bridge, symbolizing the very long journey that both children have to make. First, a sliver of ice enters the heart of little Kay. Next, and it comes from the devil's mirror and freezes his heart. Next, he is kidnapped by the wicked Snow Queen and taken away to the far north, depicted now by two English artists, Kathleen Beverley and Elizabeth Ellender. Gerda follows him bravely all the way to Lapland on the back of a friendly reindeer. The reindeer tells Gerda that he's so glad to be returning north. He was born there. He's been missing its snowy fields and glittering valleys. Further to the north they travel, Gerda and the reindeer. At last, they reach the terrible palace of the Snow Queen, lit by the northern lights, guarded by an army of living snowflakes, which looked like little white porcupines or bristly bears, says Anderson. And she finds Kay, she breaks the spell upon his heart, and she brings him home as spring reaches the north and the snow begins to melt. Well, now, when Anderson comes to write the first of his three autobiographies, he calls it the fairy story of my life. According to many people who didn't like him, they thought that meant it was just a load of rubbish, but still. Some of it, in fact, reads like a fairy story, and it is true. When he is 11, his father dies of a fever, his mother marries again, another young cobbler. They apprentice the boy, now 12, 13, to a couple of factories, including a tobacco factory. He hates the smell, he runs away, and soon after, he begs his mother to allow him to go to Copenhagen to seek his fortune in the theatre as an actor, as a dancer, or as a singer. He has a very nice soprano voice. Mother consults the local wise woman. The wise woman consults the tea leaves, and the tea leaves foretell Hans Christian will become a great man, and one day the streets of Odense will be lit up in his honor. So here they are saying goodbye, mother and son. He is wearing his father's old clothes. Father was a short man. Hans Christian, aged 14, is 6'1". Now, we know a lot about his early life and about the people from the slightly classes above him who encouraged him. They've recently found an early story of his called The Tallow Candle, dedicated to a Mrs. Bunkerflood, who used to lend him books when he was a little boy in Odense. There are lots of people, and here's another of them. This lady, with her back to us, is a Mrs. Hermansen. We know about her. She is a retired midwife. And she would go with him. She was going to Copenhagen anyway. She'd look after Hans Christian. She'd give him sandwiches and help him to find cheap lodgings in the city. didn't work out quite like that. He ended up in the red light quarter, but she didn't know, and it wasn't his. He didn't know either, so it didn't really matter. The Rosenborg Castle in Copenhagen, depicted by an artist, Christian Kubka, 5 years younger than Andersen and a leader of his day. We'll see more of his paintings as we go along. Copenhagen was then a small city, just over 100,000 people, big enough to be a city, small enough for the individual to matter, known to Danes at any rate as the Athens of the North on account of its flourishing cultural life. It is still a walled city until much later in the 19th century, and every night at this period, the keys of its four gates are handed to the king, King Frederick VI, who was reputed to sleep with them under his pillow. He, by the way, was half English, Frederick VI. His wife had been an English princess, younger sister of George III, and he was very popular. The Court Theatre in Copenhagen, scene of Andersen's ambitions for years to come, together with the Royal Theatre. Denmark's theatre was famous all over Europe for the beauty of its scenery and the excellence of its acting. Takes itself very seriously. Here is its motto, Age blut til lust, not for amusement only. So there. Its actors are admired figures. Andersen's passion is typical of a Dane of his day. He gets walk-on parts. He appears in a ballet as a gnome. He manages to have singing lessons paid for by some quite high-up well-wishers. People encourage him. They take up collections for him, but then just as things are going fairly well, what happens? He is now 15. His voice breaks. And that's when the bad times really start. He's got the wrong sort of body for a dancer. He's got the wrong sort of face for an actor. Danny Kaye to the life, is it not? Always, this is a self-portrait that he drew a few years later. Very sensitive about his appearance. He's got small eyes, he says. He compares them to green peas. He says, and a nose as mighty as a cannon. We, of course, can compare the nose to something else. That best-known self-portrait written 23 years later about these hard years in the city. And like the little bird in the cold field, Andersen hangs on, poised between the magic world of the theatre and the real world. He, on one occasion, goes to see his auntie, the brothel keeper, and she sends him away empty-handed, saying very sadly, if only you'd been a little girl. He and his father used to write plays for the puppet theatre, and he goes back to doing this, but he's never learned to write, only to read. He can't spell, he can't do grammar. He sends the plays to the Royal Theatre. They send them back. But Denmark is already gaining quite a social conscience, and in the end, someone we'll meet in a moment suggests him to the state treasury for a grant to enable him to go to grammar school. He's only been to the dame school. Now he can go to grammar school. Doesn't want to, but he goes, and in a class with boys half his age, they're all about 11, he's 17, Andersen learns to write and spell. This is a sketch of the classroom, the actual classroom, not by Andersen, by a classmate. Most subjects are new to him, in particular Latin and Greek, to the disgust of the headmaster, Professor Meisling, a classical scholar and sadist, apparently. Until the very last years of his life, he was still having nightmares about Meisling and about Mrs. Meisling, who not only made passes at him, says Andersen, he was the only sort of grown-up boy in the school, but who had the horrid habit, he complained, of keeping her pots of jam on a shelf in the outside privy. He survives lots of things. He passes his exams. He says goodbye nicely. And then at last, in Copenhagen, he begins to flower. Kristen Kubka again, leader of what has come to be called the Golden Age of Danish painting, a blossoming of Danish art and culture which coincides with Andersen's youth and of which he is a part. Earlier generations of Danes, both artists and writers, have taken their subjects from the classics and from European history in general. This is the first generation, inspired actually by the Dutch, to look about them at the common people, at the Danish landscape, and above all, at the light and the cloudscapes of the north. Now, in a little room with a nice view, Andersen writes and writes and writes. He's given up the idea of being a performer. He realizes it won't work. He's going to be a poet, a dichter. He writes poems. He writes a comic play that's put on at the Royal Theatre. He calls it Love on St. Nicholas's Church Tower. He has success, a bit of success. He can afford clothes that fit, and he begins to feel quite pleased with himself, too pleased for some. He reads his poems aloud at parties, at great length, uninvited, to impress his new friends, in particular this man, very important man, director of the Royal Theatre. This is Jonas Collin, financial advisor to King Frederick VI, and the man who had arranged Andersen's school grant, without which he would have been lost. A kind and a good man, though rather severe on the surface, becomes Andersen's second father. His sons and daughters become Andersen's adopted brothers and sisters, in spite of the class barrier of which they're all hugely aware. Andersen worships Colleen's younger son, Edward, who would be a banker. Here he is with his wife. Edward will become a lifelong friend and go to great trouble to help him to save money. In youth, he finds Andersen rather difficult. Edward is a bit stuffy and very conventional, and he can't quite take Andersen's devotion, his touchiness, his need for attention, and his passionate desire for fame. But he loves him nonetheless, and so does Henriette, and the friendship would be a lifelong one. Over the years, another well-off Copenhagen family, Andersen gets himself adopted by many such families, and he is inspired to make his paper cuts by bright little children such as these. But the Collins are always their favourites, his favourites. The Collins are a very practical family, keen on getting Andersen to conform, be socially acceptable. They try to stop him from showing off, and he puts them into his stories. Here in The Ugly Duckling, the duckling has been taken in by an old woman, her cat, you can see a cat, can't you? There's a cat, there's a hen, there's the duckling. And they have a go at the duckling. Can you lay eggs, asks the hen. No, says the duckling. Then keep your mouth shut, says the hen. Can you arch your back, asks the cat. Can you purr? Can you make sparks? No, says the duckling. In that case, says the cat, you have no right to have an opinion when sensible people are talking. Based on his relationship with the Colleen family. Another portrait by Kubka, his sister seen from a storehouse. Now, Andersen, now in his 20s, is always falling in love with the beautiful daughters of the middle classes. Another artist of a brown-eyed young woman. One morning in a country town, he falls in love with another brown-eyed young woman who's beautiful, who's witty. She's the sister of a fellow student. She takes to Hans Christian Andersen. She's already engaged. He writes telling her of his love, but wishing her joy with the other man, if that's what she wants. She apparently bursts into tears on reading the letter, but soon after writes back to say goodbye forever. He goes abroad, she marries the other man. Years later, they meet again. Andersen famous, Ribor, that's her name, married with 3 children. And he writes a story based on this second meeting. It's called Sweethearts, and it's about 2 nursery toys, a spinning top and a ball, whom are thrown out of the nursery and meet many years later in the dustbin. Now, they don't recognize each other because the spinning top has been painted with gold paint. That's Anderson becoming famous. Whereas the little ball has only lain in the gutter and got a little bit soggy and a little bit wet. You get over love, says the spinning top, when your beloved has lain in the gutter for 5 years and oozed. Now, we don't quite know whether Rebord ever read that story. Now, this is an illustration to it by Anderson's favourite illustrator, Wilhelm Pedersen, who will crop up over and over again, a young Danish naval architect whom he liked very much. So, years later, he can send up... There's the top. No. No, no. Anyway, to the top and the ball in the centre, and a little nutcracker figure. More about him tomorrow, the nutcracker figure. I've no idea who that is on the left. So later, Anderson, on many occasions in his stories, he can send up an unrequited lover of any kind. But at the time, he goes away, broken-hearted, on the first of his many travels. Here we see a beckoning path beyond. That path, for any Danes, must lead first to Germany on their way to the south, and that's where he goes. He goes to Hamburg, and then he gets his very first view of the Harz Mountains in northern Germany, and here he begins to sketch the view of the mountains by a man only accustomed to the plains. One can see that, can we not? He would walk over them with much excitement and with a Danish artist friend who encourages him to sketch. Now, Germany plays a special role in Anderson's life, as it had done for many early Danish writers and artists drawn to the nearby land of Goethe and of Schiller. He has introductions, more of that tomorrow, and he would hear of some nursery and household tales collected some years before by the brothers Jakob and Wilhelm Grimm. Some years later, he meets the Grimm brothers in Paris. He gets on very well. He's gregarious. He learns languages. I don't know how well, probably not very well, but he's very outgoing on his travels. 2 years later comes a still more exciting opportunity, fueled by a grant from the king, enabling him to make the great journey over more mountains, over the Alps to Italy. The Simplon Pass, sketched into Italy, sketched by Anderson in 1833. You know, he says, he writes to a friend, a sculptor friend, I never learned drawing, yet I often feel like sketching on paper what I cannot express in words. Friends have said I should have been a painter, and yet I once showed my sculptor friend Jericho one of my drawings, and in order to be praised, I said, I have never learned drawing. Yes, by God, you can see that, was all he said. This is another sculptor friend, better known, and who would be much more supportive, Bertel Thorvaldsen, who would become one of Anderson's greatest friends, with whom he'd go to the theatre often in Copenhagen. There was a crowd of Danish artists in Rome at that time, all of them on state grants, believe it or not, probably including the dog on the right. They were all soaking up the sun and painting and painting and painting. One you see here has been to Constantinople, perhaps, and brought back his fez and his hubble bubble. And there's the dog living on a nice state grant. Their leader is another major figure of whom we know little today. Just his name was Wilhelm Eckersberg, and his realistic portrayals of daily life among ancient buildings were much appreciated by younger generations. The October Carnival, seen and written about by Hans Christian Andersen, was a fabulous travel writer with much excitement. Now, he visits galleries and museums, and inspired by everything around him, he sketches himself. Very idiosyncratic. Here, among ancient ruins, we have a little tourist. Himself, no doubt. Here we have the house of the poet Tasso in Sorrento, and in the far distance there is Vesuvius, smoking away. He was no coward. He climbed Vesuvius while it was erupting, singing all the way. A funeral procession of Franciscan monks seen from the window of his hotel. The first portrait of Andersen. On his return to Copenhagen, he writes a novel set in Rome, but at the same time, he scribbles down a few stories. Two from Danish folk tales, The Princess and the Pea, Big Klaus and Little Klaus. One other, Little Ida's Flowers, totally original, more of that tomorrow, and another folk tale, The Tinderbox, about a soldier, a witch, a princess, and three magic dogs. And they are a success with children, and he writes more, adapting them from folk tales like the Brothers Grimm, but telling them in his own idiosyncratic way, and identifying himself with the main character in the story. This was a technique he picked up from Aesop's fables. He's also writing novels, travelogues, opera libretti, translations from the French. He does not want to be thought of as a children's writer, and he says, naivete is only part of a fairy story, its salt is its humour, which, by which he means almost invariably social satire. The Princess and the Swineherd, illustrated by Wilhelm Pedersen. The proud emperor's daughter has turned down the hand of a poor prince, so he disguises himself as a swineherd, goes and works in her father, the emperor's pigsty. While there, he makes a little cooking pot with bells all round that play very sweetly. The princess hears it, she wants it, and here she is giving him what he asks for it, 10 kisses. The original folktale version is much ruder than that. The next thing he does is to make a rattle so clever that when you swung it, it played all the waltzes, polkas, and dance tunes that had ever been written since the beginning of the world. One day, the princess is walking past the pigsty, illustrated here by Arthur Rackham. She hears the rattle. "I never heard anything so pretty," she says. "Go in, one of you, and ask him what he wants for it, but I won't kiss him." So one of the ladies went into the pigsty, but she put on wooden shoes first, and she held her nose. When she came out, her face was white. "He wants 100 kisses from the princess," she said. "He must be mad," declared the princess. She walked on a few steps, and then she stopped. "One ought to encourage art," she said. And there she is, and soon, poor girl, will be thrown out of the kingdom by her father, the emperor, who's leaning over the wall very cross. Another unfinished story, no, it's not finished, another social satire, he could be writing it now, perhaps The Darning Needle. This is his desk with an unfinished story. Once upon a time, there was a darning needle who was so stuck up and refined, she thought she was a sewing needle. "Be careful, watch what you are holding," she said to the fingers of the cook that had picked her up. "I am so fine and thin that if I fall on the floor, you'll never be able to find me again." "Oh, shut up," snarled the fingers. And they steered the needle towards the cook's slippers. The leather had split and had to be sewn. "This is vulgar work," said the needle. "I can't get through it, I'll break." And then she broke. Had it been up to the fingers, the darning needle would have been thrown away. But they had to do what the cook said. So they dipped the needle in hot sealing wax and stuck her in the cook's blouse. "Now I have become a brooch," said the needle. "When you are something, you always become something. I always thought I was born to be something better." Then she turned to her neighbour in the blouse, a pin. "May I take the liberty of asking you if you are made of gold?" she said. "You look very handsome and you have a head, even though it is small. Take my advice and let it grow a little bigger. Not everyone is so fortunate as to be dipped in sealing wax." And she drew herself up a bit too proudly, for she fell out of the blouse down into the sink just as the cook was washing up. And she ends up in the gutter, the poor needle, saying, "I am too fine for this world." And she didn't break, even though a loaded wagon drove over her. Anderson, aged 40 now, about 40, fairly secure with a pension from the king. He's written two farces. He's written two novels. He's adapted the farces for the new theatre in the Tivoli Gardens, and he has very interesting friends, in particular the scientist and physicist Hans Christian Ørsted, who would be very, very influential upon him. And thinking about Ørsted, who he said once that he loved more than anybody else in the world, Anderson would write a story called The Millennium. He would start to think of future, of inventions of his day. And he would call them Poetry's California. And he would try to write stories about them. Some are successful and entertaining, including The Millennium. In The Millennium, young Americans fly from America to England in an airship. He's writing in the 1850s. They see England in a day. They then get themselves to Europe through the Channel Tunnel. They see Europe in a week, reading their guidebook, which is called Europe in 7 Days. But it's not for stories like The Millennium that Anderson's name has survived. Ørsted also said, prophesied that his name would be, that his stories would make him immortal. More this kind of thing. The Steadfast Tin Soldier. Anderson's was always a bit soppy about soldiers. His father, for a short time, had been a soldier in the Danish army under his hero Napoleon, and had impressed the little boy with his soldier's uniform. Father and son had always seen eye to eye. He never says a bad thing about a soldier. Here, true to his duty and to his love, the white paper ballerina on the right, the tin soldier with only one leg is reduced in the nursery flames to his essence, which is a glowing heart. Another little character. This is a totally original story, one of the very early ones. Thumbelina, an inch high, grown out of a grain of barley. Here she stands on a butterfly. She's being drawn downstream by the butterfly. And here she is again with a swallow whom she's rescued from freezing to death in the winter from an international children's competition held some years ago in Odense for the best illustration of an Anderson story among children no older than 14. Danish scholars and Anderson scholars have been very upset with early English translators who didn't bother to learn Danish. One example, good example, is from the beginning of Thumbelina. Here's Anderson's beginning. There once was a woman who wanted to have a wee child of her own, but she had no idea where she was to get it from. So she went off to an old witch and said to her, "I would so dearly like to have a little child. Do please tell me where I can find one." "Nothing easier," said the witch. "Take this barley corn. Mind you, it's not the kind that grows out in the fields or that the fowls are fed with. Put it in a flower pot and see what happens." That's Anderson's story. That's how his story begins. Here's the English translator. "Once upon a time, there was a beggar woman who went to the house of a poor peasant and asked for something to eat. Something to eat. The peasant's wife gave her some bread and milk. When she'd eaten it, she took a barley corn out of her pocket and said, etc., 'This will I give to thee, put it in the flower pot.'" So, this is Mary Howitt, a friend of Charles Dickens, who was obviously afraid of arousing children's interest in where babies came from. Now, he didn't only put himself into his stories, he puts his friends in. Thumbelina is based on his oldest friend in Odense, a little hunchbacked woman of about his own age called Henriette Wolfe, very lively, very literary, the daughter of a Danish admiral who had translated the whole of Shakespeare into Danish. And she was very bright too. Here's Henriette. This was painted posthumously after both their deaths. But we can see their characters clearly. Henriette very lively. She's always having to cheer Anderson up. Often he feels, obviously, very lonely in Copenhagen, hardly surprising with the mental heritage and the social leap. One day, something ghastly happens, nothing to do with Henriette, but another woman, the last woman in the world he wants to see, appears at the door of the Hotel du Nord in Copenhagen, where he stays, doesn't have a house, stays in a hotel. Now, this woman is his half-sister, Karen Marie, his mother's daughter, he calls her, never accepts her as a sister. She has become a washerwoman, like her mother has Karen Marie. She has a common law husband. She is reasonably respectable, but she could do with a little money. Her brother gives her some. Next time she comes, he gives less. Next time she sends her husband, and he gets practically nothing at all. It's uncertain whether she was trying to blackmail him or whether, poor girl, she just felt her brother might want to help her. Well, she goes away, she dies soon after, and he never sees her again. He has this obsessive fear that she will go to the bad like his auntie and like other members of his mother's family. In his blacker moments, Anderson will compare himself to a plant growing in a swamp, reaching for the light up to the ankles in mud, risen from the depths to look upon a beautiful but alien world, like the mermaid here, who suffers vain torments for the love of a human prince. This is his birthday in an illustration by a Hungarian artist, so they're letting off all those rockets in his honor. In real life, the prince in the mermaid story, which is completely original, is based on Anderson's second love, one of the daughters of his benefactor, Jonas Collin, and the mermaid, of course. An early English illustration to the mermaid. There sits the witch, who's going to change the mermaid's tail for a pair of legs, but in exchange, she's going to cut out the mermaid's tongue. There she's letting a toad feed out of her mouth, the witch, and her chair is made, says Anderson, of the bones of drowned sailors. In his stories, he presents himself as an outsider. This is, of course, a good example. In a sketch, which I shall show you later on, we see a different kind of feeling. We see a passionate sketch of a man imprisoned in a bottle with a thin neck, trying to escape an angel hovering above. Well, it has been suggested that if Anderson was imprisoned by anything, it was by his own mind and his own passionate ambition, very strong. But in that case, his prison was also his therapy. He could write himself out of a depression, and he could do one other thing. As I mentioned before, he's good at sewing, he sews on all his own buttons, and he is handy with the scissors. This young man could easily be Anderson, who wore baggy trousers like these to hide his long, thin legs. And as we see, he's cutting out paper figures from the newspaper and giving them to the little girl. For Louise Colleen's daughter, when she marries and has children, Anderson fills 5 scrapbooks, bits of which we're going to see soon. With a number of things, magazine cuttings and his own paper cuts, such as this, little pavilion, half sun, half lion, sun head, it is called. And his figures would become more sophisticated as the children grew up. A paper cut, a mysterious snake. And the volume, that's a theatre programme, and this is a volume of the first 4 stories. That's what they looked like when they first came out. Here we have The Stork and the Dancer again. Great interest in flower arranging, possibly sparked off by one of several visits to Sweden, in which he would have seen paintings like this on the walls of the farmhouses. Here we have Christ riding into Jerusalem on a horse. This is called the Kurbitz School of Painting, and Anderson was very enthusiastic about it. From Sweden comes another source of inspiration, a young singer, Jenny Lind, with whom he falls in love. They have a lot in common: poverty in childhood, love of folk song and fairy tale. But she is 23, he is 38. She becomes a great source of inspiration to him. He writes The Nightingale for her, illustrated here by a Danish artist. Artists from all over the world have illustrated this story. Korea, this is the fisherman, first character in the story, to hear the nightingale singing in the emperor's garden, there he is, as he sets his nets in the sea. Here, from Turkey, the nightingale is being exercised by court ladies who are each holding a ribbon attached to one of the poor bird's legs. It's having an awful time. This is from the International Children's Competition. Kai Nielsen again. Anderson visited mainland Europe 29 times. Here's his luggage to prove it. It's a bit battered. Suitcases, hat case, walking stick, umbrella, and a rope to let himself out of the window in case his lodgings burned down, which they were forever doing. He was a jittery traveller, always afraid of losing his passport, missing the train, and above all, of strange dogs. And dogs knew this, and they bit him in the leg wherever he could. He goes all over Europe and part of Asia. He loved Istanbul. There he is in a nice Turkish fez. In Istanbul, he witnessed a performance by the howling dervishes that terrified him, but he's not a coward. He goes back next day, and to the whirling dervishes. Now, according to the Royal Library in Copenhagen, this watercolour is by Anderson, but it is not in his style at all, and I don't believe them. Still, that's what they say. He loves speed, and when the first train comes to Europe, he's on it. He says, life is to fly with railway flight around the earth. We're long enough underneath it. I think it's fun. He makes friends in Germany. He comes to London, tries to make friends with Charles Dickens. Friendship goes sour, alas. He goes back to Italy, he goes back to Paris. Perhaps he's most comfortable in the little Danish and German palaces and castles on and around the Baltic. This is Augustenborg Castle on the Baltic island of Aus. There he is on the left reading a story. And here is his host on the right. Before long, I'm afraid, the Duke of Augustenborg will lead an army against Denmark, and the two friends will never speak again. Meanwhile, Anderson becomes a polished courtier. Now, he doesn't touch alcohol. It doesn't suit him. Most men of his day drink pretty freely, including King Christian VII of Denmark. One evening, the two Danes are at a soiree in Paris. The king raises his glass of wine to the writer, toasts him. Nervously, Anderson returns the compliment in the water he's drinking out of a green glass he carries everywhere about in the hope of disguising the fact, but the king notices and the king is cross. When you drink with your king, says the king, you don't cheat. When I drink with my king, replies the poet, my water turns to wine. he is the subject of cartoons and caricatures. There he is as a polished courtier, as you see. they cartoon him in Denmark. Everyone gets a bit cross with him for the foreign travel. Here are a whole lot of people going to sleep. his fellow countrymen believed at the time that a good Dane knew his place, however low, and stayed at home in Denmark, however cold. Anderson does neither, and he satirizes their attitudes by the use of the character of a farmyard hen, perhaps one of these. In one story, there's a swallow who loves the south and praises its beauty. The hen says, But they don't have our nice cabbages in the south. I once spent the summer in the country with all my chicks. There was a lovely gravel pit you could go and scratch in. And the cabbages were so green, you can't think of anything nicer. But, says the swallow, it's so cold here, it freezes. That just suits the cabbages, says the hen. There was a reason for this attitude. A lake, this is the last painting by Koepke. Have I got 5 minutes more or not? Will somebody be honest? Thank you. This is painted in 1838 at a time when it was becoming very popular to fly the flag. After the losses of the Napoleonic Wars, Danish spirit is beginning to revive, but soon she will be at war again, this time with Bismarck's Prussia. And it'll last for about 16 years on and off, an isolated struggle over Schleswig-Holstein, abandoned by the powers of the day, France, Russia, and England, whose recently widowed queen would, of course, sided with Prussia, but they all stayed out of it. On both sides, young soldiers go into battle with Andersen's stories in their knapsacks. They are the children for whom he's written them, these young soldiers, for whom he has cut out his dancing figures. Germany has been the first country to recognize him. He has ties there. He begins to feel the world is mad. Years before, he had compared himself to water. Everything moves me. Everything is reflected in me, he says. And he's reflected now by the spirit of the times. Stays at home, cheers himself up, making paper cuts for lanterns for a celebration in honor of returning soldiers. Here he is, age 62, 8 years to live. He'll be photographed over 500 times, not out of vanity, but out of a desire to welcome the infant, all scientific advance, convinced through his friend Ørsted of its value to mankind. From all over the world come letters of appreciation, and rather to his surprise, Denmark honors him too. As the old woman had prophesied years ago, they do actually light up the streets in his honor. He leans out of the window of the town hall here, a tiny figure, while they sing a rather long song in the cold night air. He's always suffered from toothache, Andersen, and it comes on now, and he's jolly glad to go home. To his warm rooms in Copenhagen now, in Nyhavn, overlooking the harbour. His later years are accompanied by ailments real and otherwise. March the 1st, 1871, I am thinking of becoming at least imaginarily ill, he writes in his diary. June the 10th, 1872, I am thinking of having cholera. April the 1st, 1873, I am thinking of having rheumatism in the roof of my mouth. Invented for the last, here's his last paper cut the year before he dies, into which, again, more about paper cuts later on, he puts most of his favourite figures, and he leaves it to a Jewish family, the Melchiors, a banking family, who care for him in his last illness, which is cancer of the liver. And his letters would be used years later by a Melchior granddaughter to get herself out of occupied Denmark. When they show him the first sketch for his statue to be erected in Copenhagen, it's got children all over it, leaning up against him, sitting on his knee. I could never read aloud if I had children crawling all over me. My aim was to be a writer for all ages. And children could not represent me. I hope tomorrow to show that he was a writer for all ages in some of the stories. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.